My name is Jeff Lawrence, and I'm a graduate of Amherst College, class of 2007. I'm here with Alon Stavins, professor of Spanish at Amherst, and the co-author with the artist and writer Steve Scheinkin of the graphic novel El Iluminado, which was published in 2012 by Basic Books. Alon has written scholarly and popular press books on Latin American and Latino culture and literature, Jewish history, dictionaries, Spanglish, and many, many other things. From 2001 to 2006, Alon hosted the PBS show Conversations with Alon Stavins, where he interviewed Hispanic and Latin American personalities from Richard Rodriguez and Elena Poniatowska to the actor John Leguizamo. For a long time, I told people that he had also interviewed Shakira, but after doing a bit of research on the internet, I just realized I might have made that up. Alon was also my advisor at Amherst and the first person ever to speak to me in Spanglish, which now, 6 or 7 years later, has become my second tongue. So let's get started. El Iluminado is a murder mystery and small-town political thriller about crypto-Jews living in Santa Fe, New Mexico, the descendants, or at least possible descendants, of Iberian Jews who were forced to convert to Catholicism but secretly practiced their faith at great risk in Spain and the Americas. You've written many scholarly and nonfiction books about the intersection of Jewish and Latino history in the United States, Alon. So what attracted you to this story in particular, and why did you decide to write a graphic novel instead of an academic book?
First, let me say that I am delighted to be in conversation with you. I have admired you as a student and as a scholar for years, and to join forces in this dialogue is very exciting to me. Thank you for doing it.
Yeah.
I have been, as you said, interested in the topic of the Jewish experience in the Americas in a variety of ways and for a number of years. And in particular, the chapter of crypto-Jews has sparkled my imagination a number of times. In several scholarly books, I have mentioned the topic in passing, or I have entered it in more detail. And one particular story within that large topic has remained with me as a friend, as a companion throughout the years. It is a story that provokes me, makes me think of the actual plight, the dilemma, the quest that those secret Jews or hidden Jews or crypto Jews went through in the 16th and 17th century. That is the story of Luis de Carvajal the Younger. He was originally from Spain and was transported to the Americas thanks to his uncle, who was a prominent governor in the northern state of Nuevo León in Mexico. And because the Inquisition wasn't as mighty, as forceful, as fearful in the Americas as it was in Spain, Luis de Carvajal the Younger thought in his adolescence that he would be able to come to terms with his ancestral faith, Judaism, which the family had publicly renounced in order to fit, to align itself with the social norm in Spain, but only publicly, privately, domestically, different members of the family had remained loyal to it and would practice, engage in the different types of rituals on the Sabbath or during the high holidays, away or as far as they could from the large Catholic population. The plight of Luis de Carvajal the Younger is extraordinary because he not only decided that he was going to come out of the closet, so to speak, and declare that he was a Jew, but he also thought of himself a prophetic figure, a kind of biblical leader that would help other crypto Jews come out of their own hidden self and reveal the Judaism that they had carried in their blood for generations and generations. And in doing so, he obviously came against the inquisitors who saw him as a heretic, as a dangerous political figure, and ultimately brought him to justice, or at least to the type of justice, the type of the oppressive alignment that they thought he was due. Luis de Carvajal the Younger is probably the most important victim of an auto de fe ever to take place in Mexico at the very end of the 16th century in a very public performance that took place right at the heart of Ciudad de Mexico, of the capital. There are paintings and all sorts of literary descriptions about that particular event. And I have thought about that event, Jeff. For many years, I have watched and studied the photographs, the paintings, the movies that have been made. There is a movie called El Santo Oficio, The Holy Office, that deals with the plight of Luis de Carvajal the Younger. And I thought that it would make for a wonderful narrative story. And it was only, now I come to the second part of your question, or to your second question, it was only when meeting a wonderful artist and novelist himself, he writes books for young adults, Steve Schenken, and during a conversation that I thought maybe this is something that I should try my hand in a different type of genre, that is the graphic novel, a form that I adore, that I have hesitantly engaged in, and probably this should be an effort that I do jointly with Steve. And indeed, after a series of back and forths and all sorts of kind of imaginary strategies that we would take to figure out how to bring the story of Luis de Carvajal the Younger to the present, how to do it both with images and with text, and how to present it to an audience that was as large as possible, given that this is a historical topic about which very few people know about, we decided that it should be a very vivid murder mystery presented through these cartoons, these drawings, that it should be a graphic novel in the tradition of, Will Eisner and Art Spiegelman, you know, tackling a big topic, but also presenting it in a way that can become accessible to different types of readers. And I can say that having done many collaborations in different forms with philosophers and journalists and translators and theater directors and movie makers, this has been one of the happiest, the collaboration with Steve, the product of which is this graphic novel, El Iluminado.
Great, yeah. This is actually the first time I've seen the book as a finished product, because I read some earlier versions of it, and the illustrations are really incredible. And I would say specifically regarding what you just said about the historical aspects, one of the most incredible things about the graphic novel is how it weaves together this historical event through pictures and also through the telling of this story about Carvajal with this very gripping modern-day murder mystery and political thriller. So I'm wondering in that sense, too, what was it that led you to the story of Rolando, who is a Latino man who is living in Santa Fe, Mexico, right? And has the novel begins with his mysterious death, but who was trying to uncover his family's secret Jewish past when he died. So I'm wondering about how these two, the historical narrative about Carvajal, and then also Rolando's, the story of Rolando trying to recuperate his own Jewish past, was something that came to you, or that you decided upon as a narrative technique. So at one point, the character in the novel named Stavins, your alter ego, says, "What interests me in all this is the way people create stories to survive, to affirm who they are, to make a stand." So I wonder, is that something that you believe in terms of the power of narrative, or is it more your character sort of speaking in the voice of an alter ego?
It's a wonderful question, Jeff. It's certainly something that I believe. The character of Professor Stavins that shows up in the book, and the leading figure that tries to solve this big mystery surrounding the death of Rolando, the crypto-Jew that dies very early in the story, is an expression of many of the quests that I have had and many of the inner thoughts that I nurture when dealing with a topic that connects with identity, and identity not only in the present but also in the past, as it does in this book. The story itself, I think you're going to be interested in this. The story itself actually happened to me, not in full, but at least in its very basic elements, when a few years ago, I forget exactly how many, maybe 3 or 4, I was invited to give a keynote address at the Museum of New Mexico. There was a series of events connected with some sort of a festival of Sephardic, Mexican, Jewish culture in the Southwest, and this was going to be one of the important scholarly events that related to that festivity. I found myself both intrigued by the topic that I was invited to talk about, and that is the Jews of New Mexico, and in particular the crypto-Jews. Intrigued, I say, but also somewhat frightened, because here I was, an Ashkenazi Jew. Ashkenazi Jews, as you know, are those who trace their roots to Eastern Europe, who was going to be talking to what ended up being a large constituency of Jews that might have been, some of them at least, connected with the Ashkenaz, with Eastern Europe, but many were really from Spain or descended from Spain and had moved to the Balkans or moved to Italy or to the Netherlands or Northern Africa, which are the parts of the Jewish diaspora that emerged immediately after the expulsion from Spain in 1492, and had kept their religion, their faith, going, if not intact, for many generations. So here I was going to go and talk about secrecy and deceit and strategies to remain loyal to one's own faith to people who knew that very story in their own flesh and blood, and who probably could tell me directly many anecdotes that would freshen up the topic that I had. And I chose to begin the conversation with a series of reflections on Luis de Carvajal the Younger. In particular, he is also nicknamed El Iluminado, and thus the title of the book. And I showed a number of images on the screen. I talked about the path of the Jewish immigration or the Jewish exile from Spain to different parts of Europe and Africa. And the questions at the end of the talk were fascinating. They were questions that connected very deeply and in a very autobiographical way with the topics that I had raised. And that's exactly what I had been hoping for, that my audience wouldn't feel that this was an outsider, a scholar who looks at things objectively, who is distant, who is scientifically prone to understand this phenomenon, and thus is cold in the sense of reluctant to make it come alive. They were telling me the story from their own view, making it hot, making it attractive, and we were able to create a dialogue to find some sort of bridge in between that was fascinating, simply fascinating. There was an audience of, I don't know, 300 or 400 people. After the event, a number of members in the audience came to me and started telling me more about what they had said in that question and answer session. And there was one woman in particular who kind of stayed behind, waited for the rest of the people to tell me what they were going to tell me. And when she had more space and time, she began to describe the story of a relative of hers who had recently been ostracized by the family because he had discovered that there were crypto-Jewish elements in the family. And she stressed to me in very vivid detail that the recognition that this member had come across was something that was very important for his own self-definition, but had also pushed the family to create turfs, to fight, to disengage with one another, that siblings wouldn't talk because one of them was thinking that they were cryptojews, and the other one was thinking that the brother was imagining all this, that there all these elements were really not accurate. And the way she was describing the story really made me feel that she had a truth in her that was invaluable. She invited me to go to have dinner after the event. There was a reception, and I was full, but I said, yeah, sure, let's go. We'll have a taco. We went to a Mexican restaurant. And the conversation continued, and she gave me more and more details about this sibling, this relative of hers, who had actually, at that point, told me, who had recently died. And so the story stayed with me, and as you know, that's the very beginning of El Iluminado. I am the character of Professor Stavans, is giving a lecture in the Museum of New Mexico in Santa Fe. He is describing the story of Luis de Carvajal, and then there are members of the audience who attack him for presenting it in a kind of scientific way of not being a Sephardic Jew, that is a Jew from Spain himself. And there's one member of the audience, Irina, who lingers and then invites him, and thus the story begins. What happens from there on, Jeff, really is a mix of truth and imagination, as all novels are. I believe all fiction is autobiographical, and all autobiography is fictional as well. So I allowed myself the freedom to massage some of the stories that I had heard that day, some of the information that the character, who's really not named Irina, but that I ended up describing as by that name, told me, and then connecting the past with the present, which for me was really the essential task that I had before I started, how to bring history to the present and how to bring the present to the past, and how to make the two run parallel but not feel as if they are divorced from one another. And that is what happens in the novel through that device of the manuscript or the written document that exists that serves as a bridge between those two spheres, temporal spheres, the past and the present.
Yeah, that's a wonderful and an incredible story that I couldn't have even imagined, because I was assuming that there was some element of truth to the beginning of this, but also that even from the beginning that a lot of this was fiction and embellishment. So it's interesting because, one of the things that is said to the character Stavans, to Professor Stavans in the novel, is that he has a penchant for confusing life and literature. So I wanted to get your opinion on what you think of the mix of fact and fiction. I know one of the things I noticed was that there was a lot of references to Amherst people in the novel. As you mentioned, one of the reasons that you go to Santa Fe is to give a talk on crypto Jews. But in the novel, you also go to New Mexico to see a performance of an adaptation of Calderón de la Barca's Life is a Dream at the Santa Fe Opera House, which, as I know from talking to you and from, general Amherst news, was a performance an adaptation whose libretto was written by Amherst professor Jim Marinus. So all of that actually happened. And on the other hand, we find out early in the novel that the Santa Fe chief of police is Cesar Alegre, another professor at Amherst. And I assume that part is not true.
Right. He has never been a detective.
So I was wondering, with the sort of blending of real and fictional Amherst characters, did you have a specific Amherst audience in mind, or was this something that was just one other way of bringing autobiography ethnography in? And then just more specifically, do you see yourself as the hero or the anti-hero of the novel, or something in between? Sort of how did you write yourself as a protagonist of the novel?
Well, very shrewd questions and very provocative, as expected from you, Jeff. I can tell you first that there was something in your previous question, the one that I answered just a little while ago, that is still pending, and I would like to use it as a springboard to connect with this topics that you, and that is, what is the role of storytelling in our lives, and to what extent storytelling is part of our identity? And I think the answer, Jeff, is the novel itself. I believe that we tell each other, we tell ourselves stories all the time in order to be alive. And without those stories, we would not exist. We would vanish. We would lose our memory. We would lose our sense of who we are and who others are. A driver's license is a story. Is a story of a name, a story of the age of an individual, of the gender, of the image, a passport, a book, simply the image that we see on the mirror. But waking up in the morning and telling one's son, I had a dream, and in this dream, you showed up in the middle of a river. There was a canoe, and we were having breakfast together. You know, that dream doesn't change my relationship with my son, but it is precisely that dream that makes my relationship with my son what it is. The fact that the dream is insufficient if I don't tell it to somebody that I love. I don't want for the dream to be interpreted. I simply want it to be shared, and I would like to hear other dreams from people that I love, because I want to share them too. And that sharing, that insistent way of narrating our lives to others, to letting others narrate who they are to us, is, I think, what makes us humans. That is what religion is all about. That's what politics is all about. That is what culture in general is, the act and art of telling stories. Of course, there are stories that are true, and there are stories that are untrue. And the stories that are true are the stories in which we deliver factually the things that happen to us. But to what extent is everything that happens to us factual? Going back to that particular dream, Jeff, when I tell a dream to my son, the dream comes alive. The dream really never existed, or if it existed, there's no proof of it. I can't show him anything of the dream to prove that there was a canoe, that there was some food that we were going to eat together. But it is in the story that the dream becomes a reality. And anything that we tell ourselves, in many ways, is an invention. The dreams are inventions, and our identities are inventions. We want to become engineers, or we want to become psychologists, or we want to become professors. And in wanting, we dream narratives in which hopefully one day we will fit in and turn them into a reality. I would like to add to this one more point, and that is that I am an immigrant, as you know. I was born and raised in Mexico and came to the United States. And I think that immigrants, this is another element that shows up in the book, immigrants are really connected with origin stories about themselves in a way that is forced upon by their own existential plight. I was one Ilan in Mexico and became another Ilan in the United States, speaking a different language, dressing in a different way, eating different food, doing things, moving my hands in a way that is not necessarily the one that I use when I speak in Spanish. And so one leaves as an immigrant with a sense that there are two or more selves trapped inside us. And those selves push for space, pushed to manifest themselves. And the question that always comes is, which of all those selves is the accurate one, or the authentic one, or the factual one? And I wouldn't be able to tell you. I think that there are parts of me when I speak English that I think falsify the essence of who I am, and there are parts of me in Spanish that do exactly the same. And in the end, that falsification is what drives me forward as a writer, and as a both as a scholar and as a fiction writer. I think that all writers end up having the material that they are going to be writing about just in front of their noses. That is, in their childhood or in their adolescence, it has been said that most of what a writer is going to end up writing in his or her life happened in the first 10 years, and the rest is just a kind of consequences of that, that the raw flesh was already set in those early periods. I'm not so sure. I think there's a lot that I write about that connects to my childhood or to my adolescence, but there's a lot more that connects to my daily circumstances. And I spend a lot of my time teaching, a lot of my time wandering around Amherst, talking to people, loving people, engaging with them, telling them my story and hearing their stories. And I wanted to make this book a campus book as well, without or beyond the campus walls. And as you might remember from the book, there is an ongoing critique that is made by various characters of Professor Stavans, that he's a scholar, that scholars tend to be kind of absent-minded and distant from society, and that he tries to bridge this gap, but this generates envies and rivalries, and to what extent are academics always creating those rivalries? I wanted to laugh at myself and with myself about what it means to be an academic, and how in what a little world that is.
Right. Yeah. That's all of this makes me think. All of the what you've said about sort of the role of the writer in society, the role of the academic in society, also the real anxieties that you had about giving a talk on crypto-Judaism to people who were part of a community that had, to a certain degree, suffered or lived the experience of being crypto-Jews for generations, I think brings me to one of what I consider to be the hard questions that I was going to ask you today, and that was about Professor Contreras. So, mm-hmm. In the novel, the character Arch Stavins' arch nemesis is an academic, Professor Contreras, who also has traveled to Santa Fe to research crypto Jews, but he has a very different relationship to these communities in New Mexico than Stavins does. And so while Stavins accuses Contreras of being an elitist who's just coming to study them scientifically, Contreras says that, accuses Stavins of basically not doing serious scholarship. Right. So I was wondering about this. What you say that this was a critique of academics. What is it exactly? Does this mean that you're being an academic, that you're against academics, or would it be more fair to say that that the character Stavins and maybe you yourself have a problem with the typical or the type of academic that Contreras represents? So I'm just wondering how you see the role of the academic in the novel.
I believe that what we do, Jeff, and you are about to complete your PhD at Princeton. You're writing an extraordinary thesis and have a very promising career in front of you. You already know what all this means, and you will get to taste it in ways that will emphasize what you already think, and at the same time provoke you to think other types of thoughts. I think there's something extraordinary about the role of being given being given the opportunity, being invited by society to become a scholar. That is, to spend your entire life around books, connected with knowledge, thinking, and using that thought to engage young people and prepare them for life. There is, you know, I never really set out to be a teacher. I had other dreams when I was a young man. I wanted to be a filmmaker. I wanted to be involved in journalism. And it was for a variety of practical reasons, mainly that I, at one point, having been a correspondent for a Mexican newspaper in New York City, I wanted to stay in this country, and I needed a visa, and that visa was connected with the doing a PhD, that I became a teacher, and here I am thinking of myself in those terms, right. And I would not change it for a second. It gives me enormous pleasure, every day of my life to know that I have the opportunity that day or the next day to enter the classroom yet again and talk about the books that I adore and have changed my life and share that passion with a young generation that is about to discover them. And hopefully those books will change their lives in the same way that they did mine. But at the same time, there is a pitiful mediocrity in all professions, and certainly in the profession of being academics. We can hide behind institutions. We are protected by tenure and other structural benefits that enable us to speak freely about topics, and some of us take those opportunities and do engage in free talk, and others of us hide behind those platforms and really not enter topics, or at least not all the time in the way we should. And I also think that that mediocrity generates all sorts of rivalries that are sad and troublesome. And I would round this thought, Jeff, by telling you that in the end, the way I see myself is that I am as proud of the great friends that I have made in life, and friendship is the first and most important quality that the world offers you. Retaining friends, nurturing them, being with them for all sorts of opportunities is the most privileged aspect of an individual's life. And at the same time, one should be as proud of one's enemies, and I'm using the word enemy here, as one is of our friends. I think that we nurture enemies with the same type of passion and endurance, because we define our ideas vis-a-vis or against the ideas of others. And the character of Contreras, I think you know it because you read an earlier version of this book, in which actually the name of one of those figures out there, an opponent, was still used, and they very cautiously, you and others said it might be better that if you change it to another name. And I chose Contreras, as you know, because Contreras means opponent or contrarian, right. In Spanish. But it is based on someone who has been an interlocutor with me throughout my career, pushing me to be sharper, to define my arguments better, because his arguments are always on the other side. And I assume that I play a similar role. I've never spoken to him about this, but I assume that I play a similar role with him. I think in the end, there are people out there and there are books out there that we read against or that we engage against, and that we are better people because we see that other side of ourselves projected, and know that we have to be cautious, that we have to be concise, that we have to be factual and scientific. So I wanted to pay tribute to that figure here too. And Contreras is a real person, I thank him the way I thank writers that I don't like for showing me the type of writers that I like.
I really like that. I mean, it's almost like a much more generous form of sort of Nietzsche's idea of enemies, which is essentially that the enemies are ones that are in some ways more beneficial to you than friends.
No doubt, sure.
And also, of course, that friends can sometimes be enemies if one doesn't, if one doesn't, in a sense, be honest with them. And so I did find that character very illuminating for me, particularly since I am entering into the academic profession. And I wanted to ask you...
Let me just add, if I can interrupt you for a second.
Yeah.
Jeff, there is a website connected with El Iluminado, mm-hmm. In which Contreras has written a letter arguing that the portrait that emerges of him in this book is demeaning, that the book defames him, and that people shouldn't read it.
Okay, I'll make sure to check that out. Yeah, a lot of what you're saying right now also resonates a lot with me because, as you know, you were the first person also to recommend to me the works of Roberto Bolaño, the Chilean writer who died in 2003 and about whom I wrote my undergraduate thesis. And so we've worked, you helped me with that. I did my dissertation or my thesis with you, and now we've continued to talk about the figure of Bolaño and his works for a long time, and I know you taught a course on Bolaño's works a couple of years ago. And I'm wondering particularly about what you say in terms of academics hiding behind institutions, whether or not Bolaño's work has influenced this novel. And I just have there's one particular way that I think I read it as being in dialogue with Bolaño, and that is that in 2666, his final novel, the whole first part of the novel, the part of the critics, is essentially about a group of academics, and in some ways very endearing academics, who are sort of torn from European academics who are torn from their institutional landscapes in Europe, basically, and who come to Mexico, who come to Ciudad Juarez in order to search for a writer, and end up being faced by the femicides, these sort of very brutal crimes against women in Juarez, and it seems that there's something that changes in them. It's the beginning of a novel that may have seemed like a sort of game, literary game among academics, but then became about something that was much more concerned with real life. And I know that I imagine that to a certain extent, you identify with that academic who is in a way forced to become a public intellectual or wants to become a public intellectual or wants to not remain or wants to get out of the ivory tower. So I'm wondering, first of all, were you thinking at all of Bolaño when you were writing this, or do you think that this is something more like a kind of literary zeitgeist among certain contemporary writers that may have to do with the increasing, the increasing maybe insularity of academic work, or what do you think that is?
I'm excited, thrilled, really, to be again talking about Bolaño with you. The conversation mm-hmm. continues. It started when you were as an undergraduate, and it will take us many, many years, Jeff, together to figure out how Bolaño has changed us. And it has. You thank me for introducing you to Bolaño. I thank you. I have already done so, but here I go again. I thank you for being a student who was eager and ready to read Bolaño seriously as an undergraduate and to delve into his work with commanding vision. And in so doing, you were as important to me as perhaps I was to you, allowing me to see Bolaño through your eyes and understand that his dilemma goes beyond a single reader and a single generation of readers and a single nationality of readers, but is broad and open. Bolaño is a writer that I admire profusely. I see so many things of his work in so many aspects of life that it is not unfair to say that after reading him 5-6 years ago, I was one Ilan and today I'm a very different one. That difference I couldn't fully account for. It is the type of reaction that one has to a work of art that changes us forever in ways that go beyond words, even though this work of art is made of words. The way Bolaño builds a sentence, the way Bolaño presents a character, the kind of fluid way of letting a story wander and wander as he is trying to build a plot that which in the end ends up being in the end is quite loose and gives you the impression that it's going nowhere, is in me all the time, even when I am not consciously thinking of Bolaño. And I would emphasize that my own view of who I am as an academic has also changed as a result of Bolaño's exploration. He was never an academic, but he was very interested with what we in academia do with literature. And that first part of 2666 is a critique of a literature in the hands of the people that supposedly know and handle it and control it. I think that that El Iluminado is a Bolañesque novel. It sounds like an Italian dish. It's really more an indirect tribute to him. I think that the self-criticism that I engage in, the fact that academia is anxious and unstable and always fighting and creates all these enemies within ourselves and the outside world is there. And also his magical quality to summarize an entire condition, an entire issue, an issue that defines us as individuals in one sentence or in one particular paragraph, a paragraph about what poetry might be or a paragraph about why we kill each other in the way that in Ciudad Juarez women are being killed all the time. In a single paragraph, he can do much more than another writer might do in an entire book. And I think he has something of Cervantes in him. I've always thought, I think you and I have talked about this, that there's a Don Quixote quality in Bolaño as a writer. And of course, in many of his characters, in the Savage Detectives, there are two characters that are leading the story. And although they are not really quite like the knight and his squire, Alonso Quijano and Sancho Panza, this quest, the dialogue that the two maintain and the way they try to solve a mystery that entails the functioning of the entire world that surrounds them is very Cervantian. And I would say that in response to your question, there's no doubt in me that I am in dialogue with Bolaño, and also that in my being in dialogue with him, we are in dialogue with Cervantes, which is always the fountain, the primary source, the very aleph of what the Hispanic world is.
Right. Yeah. So that's wonderful, and we wouldn't want to forget Borges too, because I mean, you have just mentioned the aleph, and I was thinking that that a lot of these plays, you know, between Cervantes and Bolaño, particularly in terms of representing one's alter ego, we would have to include Borges. And so my last question is I want to go back a little bit to the theme of the crypto Jew in the novel, and to ask you a question I think that opens out from the novel onto contemporary politics and society. So there are many points in the novel, I think, where it's suggested that there's an implicit parallel between the expulsion and persecution of Jews under the Spanish crown and the story of Luis de Carvajal and the plight of the Jews, of these crypto Jews who are living in the Southwest today. And yet at the very beginning of the novel, in the talk that he's giving, the character Stavins remarks, and this is a quote, "After centuries of shame, being Jewish is now fashionable in Western civilization," end quote. And that was a very interesting comment to me because, to a certain extent, I was was raised Jewish as a half Jew in Salt Lake City, which is a very strange environment because, since Mormons think that they're descended from the tribes of Israel, I actually didn't really have an understanding even of what it meant to be a Jew when I was growing up. But when I came to Amherst, to be honest, it was the first time that I had ever felt really Jewish, and I understood exactly what the character Stavins says in this novel, which was that by acknowledging or identifying myself as a Jew, that there was a certain advantage or cachet. And so I'm wondering, in through all of the novel, one of the threads of the novel is about persecution. And I'm wondering whether that is a topic that we still see with for Jews today in the United States, or if it's something that we would have to go elsewhere other than maybe mainstream society in order to see. Because I know that for me, I think it's a very different situation and a very different world now from what my grandmother, you know, Rosalie Roth Rosenblum, lived in the 1930s, you know, in the 1930s and 40s. So I'm wondering just how you see that as a question that maybe could open out from the book.
The edition of the New York Times today has an article about a statement that Egypt's President Morsi made some years ago about the Jews. He describes the Jews as being vicious and says that they descend from pigs and apes.
Right.
This statement is now coming back to haunt him. He pronounced it when he was the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood. Mm-hmm. Today he is the president of Egypt, and his role, as he has acknowledged, currently is to serve as a mediator, as a pacifier, to use a term that he has employed, of the various forces and entities that constitute the Middle East, which is always on the verge of explosion and collapse.
Right.
It would be ironic to suggest, on the very day that I read that, that the Jews are now about to assimilate, that they are no longer persecuted, that they are no longer the target of stereotypes, of ridicule, of accusations, of laughter, and so on. But one would need to make a distinction between what goes on outside the United States,
right,
outside certain countries in Europe, and in the rest of the world. Where I grew up in Mexico, this type of rhetoric, you know, that I descended from a family that probably had a pig's tail, that we prayed to a pork in synagogue, that we were Christ killers, that we had horns then that were surgically eliminated by plastic surgeons, many of whom are Jews themselves, that the Jews control the media, that the Jews control the world,
right,
so on and so forth. It was something that I would listen on an ongoing basis in the period of growing up. And I never experienced a physical act of violence, but now that I think of all this, these statements were verbal attacks, which never really came as verbal attacks. They were innuendos. They were suggestions by neighbors or by friends who were curious, whose parents had told them that maybe it is true, but that they shouldn't ask, and the kids had become indiscreet and would ask these questions. I think that what is happening in the United States with the Jewish community is an anomaly, not only in the rest of the world, but in Jewish history. Jews have really never, ever been as comfortable, as happy, as adapted to mainstream society as they are in the United States today. Maybe that is a triumph. Maybe we have reached within this country the apex of stability. Maybe, on the other hand, this is also a mirage. Maybe this is a passing moment in history, and we will return inevitably to the same type of dilemma of being seen as the aggressor, the Judas figure, the one that is undermining stability and continuity, in that this sense of tranquility will disappear and soon. I have to tell you, Jeff, maybe we've talked about this in the past, I envy my own kids for the freedom, the openness with which they have been raised in the United States as Jews and Latinos. And sometimes, secretly, to myself, and I have also, now that they are a little older, expressed it to them, have wished, kind of in a macabre kind of way, that they had a little taste of the discomfort that I had growing up, of that anti-Semitic rhetoric. It would give them a sense of difference, of confidence, and of continuity with the past. I don't believe that the history of crypto Jews in the Southwest would be what it is had Jews not entered mainstream American society as they have since World War II. The crypto Jews in the Southwest today feel that they can align themselves with the Jewish history, with Jewish affairs, because it is not a subject of ridicule in this country to be a Jew. It might be outside of the United States, but not inside. And insofar as this is hip, it is attractive, it is cool, then why not do it? It couldn't have happened 50 years ago and wouldn't have happened 100 years ago. It happens now because now it is allowed to be Jewish in the United States. And Latinos who have been Jews in different ways for a long period of time are now coming to terms with that part of our own religious and social and spiritual history.
That's wonderful. I just wanted to say that what struck me so much about this novel was, on the one hand, how through the character of Stavins you voiced that sort of the idea of this being an anomaly for certain people in certain places, but on the other hand, how a lot of that has to do with one's perspective, where one lives in the United States, but also within the world. And is one of the most fascinating things about the book, to a certain extent, is that we tend, and this is obviously a generalization, but we tend in the United States to think about fiction in identitarian terms, right? So we have, you know, the Jewish American novelist that we look at, we have, you know, Latino novelists that we look at. Mm-hmm. And one of the really interesting things to me about this novel is the way that it weaves those two histories through a lot of the use of Spanglish, which we haven't talked about as much, but that's also one of our favorite topics when we're discussing. And so that really gives you a sense of also of one might say a Jewish experience that is very infrequently talked about, and that I think that the novel explores in a really incredible way.
Thank you. I'm delighted that you concealed that, and that was one of the things that I was trying to accomplish. And I'm thrilled that At the end of the conversation, we've gone back to Spanglish, which is absolutely true. It is the language that nos comunicamos, you and I, constantemente in these days. I appreciate enormously, Jeff, the commitment that you've made to the book and to this conversation, and look forward to many more to come, and to following your success in becoming a reader of your work and functioning as a conversant in the future of your work.
Great. Well, thank you so much for this and for the book, which was incredible and which I will continue to read. It's a beautiful book as well, with the illustrations of Steve. And thanks again.
Un fuerte abrazo. Muchas gracias.
Gracias.